G'day humans, Merry Christmas, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. And dangerous ideas are the bread and butter of today's guest, Konstantin Kissin, the host of one of the most popular podcasts in the world with his friend Francis Foster, Trigonometry, where they chat with heterodox guests from across the political spectrum. I was on the show last year. You can watch that interesting conversation at the link in the show notes. Konstantin was born in the Soviet Union, moved to the United Kingdom when he was 11 years old. He went viral in 2023 for a speech that he gave at the Oxford Union Student Debating Society, arguing that woke culture has gone too far. That made him a bit of a poster boy for certain elements on the right, including in the United States. And I wanted to sit down with Konstantin on this show and talk about the problems in Britain, the problems in the media, the problems in podcasting, taxation and welfare and multiculturalism and the broader media landscape and how he thinks about platforming extreme voices. I also wanted to get stuck into it a little bit with him on climate change, which he and I don't see eye to eye on, and get stuck into it. We did. I loved this conversation. I hope you do too. The one, the only, Konstantin Kissin.
I wrote an article last week saying there's good news for Britain, things are really bad. And that's kind of where I'm at. I feel like we are so far down the path of being unable to deal with the problems that we have, that the only way we will deal with the problems that we have is if things get so bad that people... It's kind of like that situation where you most people have had that relationship or an addiction or a job where it's like it really, really sucks, but not quite enough for you to do anything about it. That's where we are, I feel.
Right, and you're waiting for rock bottom.
Yeah, I'm excited for rock bottom is an odd turn of phrase. I'm not excited about it because it'll be very unpleasant for a lot of people, but I just feel that is the only way we get back to normalcy or just forward towards some kind of new normalcy.
What if it's instead the path towards extremism?
I think that we are already on the path towards extremism, and it's inevitable if the status quo continues. So in some ways, I almost think that if that were to happen, there is more of a chance of avoiding extremism because the people will be confronted with the reality of needing to actually take action. Because part of the thing that's happening on the extremism is a lot of the extremist rhetoric from both left and right is not geared towards solving the actual problem. Wherein you have an actual real problem that's really, really bad, that's when both left and right, some portions of them at least, will have to get serious.
And what is
but
it,
the risk you're pointing out is totally, totally there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I worry that the bigger the stresses become, the more tempting it is to reach for those easy solutions rather than come together for collaborative and sophisticated solutions. What exactly are the problems that you see the UK and the West more broadly facing?
Well, those are two separate questions slightly, because in the UK, we have a more specific problem that they, for example, do not have in the US. The number one problem that Britain faces is the economy. We are poorer today than we were before the financial crisis in 2007, 2008 on a per capita basis. So all of the other stuff that people talk about, like immigration, illegal immigration, lots of other things that have become the mainstream consensus to the point where the Labour Home Secretary now sort of sounds a little bit like Enoch Powell, while not doing anything, but sounds like it, right? The main reason for all of that is, you know, partly it's cultural, of course, but the main reason is just the country is poorer than it was. Not only not getting richer, but actually is poorer. And that means lots of things. It means that not only are people finding it harder to get good jobs. It also means infrastructure is crumbling and is not being improved. So I just spent 2 weeks without running water in the town where I live, simply because the water companies are not able to spend enough money and have a good enough organization to maintain what are largely Victorian built water systems, for example. It's the same with the trains. It's the same with everything. So the economic issue is number one. On top of that, you've got A, economics, B, infrastructure, and C, you've got I mean, I don't think it's overstating the case to say that in the big cities, petty crime has effectively become part of daily life. So I was walking through Mayfair a couple of months ago. I saw a guy in a balaclava on one of those e-bikes snatch a kind of boutique bag off an American tourist. It was kind of a weird moment because you realize how we are all kind of NPCs in those moments where we don't know what to do, because he was like, "Hey, come back here." And I was like, I don't think he's coming back, mate. But anyway.
Oh, I wasn't going to come back, but now that you shout out at me like that.
That's right. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing about that was interesting is a interesting choice of word, because it wasn't interesting. It was kind of horrifying to me, was that I was staying the night in London, and then I had a bunch of meetings with people the next day. And literally everybody that I talked to about, I was shocked by this incident because I don't live in London. Everyone I talked to was like, "Oh yeah, my daughter was mugged on the bus the other day coming from school. Oh yeah, my phone's just been snatched. Oh yeah, this. Oh yeah, this. Oh yeah, that. Oh yeah, that." So the kind of sense that there is a low level of crime that goes effectively unpunished and unprosecuted and unpursued, and it's just become part of life, is the case as well. That's partly, again, about economics. It's about not having police officers to do the job. And, you know, people will say, well, yeah, they've got the resources to arrest people for tweets, which turns out they do. But I don't think that's necessarily the primary vehicle through which that problem exists. It exists mainly because there's not enough police officers walking the streets and preventing crime and prosecuting that crime and putting those people in prison. So you've got that. Then on top of that, you know, I've told this story 1,000 times, but perhaps your audience may not have heard of it. When I came to Britain in 1996, 55,000 people a year came into this country net legally, i.e. go to an embassy, apply for a passport, get on a plane, come to Britain, we welcome you in. Today, that's the number of people who come into the country illegally every year. And these people are being put up in hotels, they're being put up in military bases. It's costing us, at one point, it was costing us £10 million a day. Today, it's probably more than that in various, and that's just for accommodation, that's not for lots of other things. So it creates a sense of A, we don't have money. B, we're spending on other people. This is all very unfair. And the conversation about illegal immigration has broken out of the sort of right-wing echo chamber and is just now completely mainstream.
So just taking those things separately, the sort of declining infrastructure, the petty crime and immigration. On declining infrastructure, of course, what the left would say is that this is what the right always does, which is impose austerity and underfund public services. And then when everything falls apart, find a convenient scapegoat like illegal immigrants to blame, when really the problem is that there hasn't been enough funding to keep up with the demand in the UK. Is there a grain of truth to that, or is that wrong?
There is a grain of truth to that, in the sense that you can't keep investing money in infrastructure when you don't have money. So when the Conservative government came in, of which I was no fan even remotely, they tried to do austerity. They didn't do austerity. They've reduced spending by a tiny, tiny, tiny amount, and in many ways continued to grow it. But when you're running debt at more than 100% of GDP, you are going to have to cut some things. But the issue isn't really about that for me. For me, the issue is that you can't fund public services if your economy isn't growing, and our economy isn't growing. And part of the reason the economy isn't growing is that we've got this thing called net zero, which is basically, we've got the most expensive electricity prices in the world, industrial electricity prices in the world. So you can't run a business that requires electricity, basically, and be competitive. On top of that, because we have this thing called net zero, we outsource all of our manufacturing to other countries where they make these things in a dirtier way, and then we ship them back to the UK using big tankers that burn bunker fuel, the dirtiest kind of fuel you can imagine. But because it's off the books, we get to say we're really clean and green and wonderful. So basically, we've destroyed our manufacturing and also made consumer electricity prices very expensive. And then we've got the highest tax burden in peacetime ever. So anyone who wants to run a business, anyone who's industrious, creative, et cetera, is basically leaving the country. That's one of the other things that people don't talk about. We spend a lot of time talking about the fact that people fleeing other countries are coming to Britain, many of them illegally. But actually, tens of thousands of our best people are fleeing Britain to go to other countries.
I had lunch with a friend of mine who's a lawyer, Constantine, last week when I was in London, and she was saying that there are so many cases which are just backlogged in the legal system that people will find themselves, you know, cases that should be ordinarily, you know, through the system in months are now taking years. And there are, even just to get on the docket at, you know, certain chambers, it'll be a 2027 date for your first hearing. And I was just baffled because I was like, why not just spend the money to, and she was saying that, like, oftentimes there'll be, you know, in the middle of summer, they'll have to just cancel or postpone trials because it'll be so hot because the air conditioning has broken in these old 1700s buildings, which they are running the trial in. And I was like, why isn't there a quorum of people who are fed up enough that they insist that there's adequate funding for that, for police and petty crime? I mean, I would have thought that a Giuliani-style figure, like Giuliani in the 90s, I mean, with a zero-tolerance, broken-windows approach to cracking down on crime, would be very successful as a mayor of London. Why are those political... why is there not sufficient political will for it?
Because there's not sufficient money for it. Because one of the things is, lots of people, if you ask people, should we spend more money on X or Y or Z, they'll all say yes. But the question is, where does our money come from?
There's always ways to raise new revenue, isn't there, Constantine? I mean, you know, you have a wealth tax, or you would increase corporate taxes, or there are all kinds of things that lefties would propose that would raise more money.
Yeah, the problem is we're at the point in the Laffer curve where raising more taxes actually reduces your tax take.
Just explain the Laffer curve.
So the Laffer curve is the relationship between tax rates and tax revenue. And it turns out that when you raise taxes beyond a certain point, you actually begin to collect less revenue in tax revenue than you would with lower tax rates.
Because you get slower growth.
No growth or negative growth, if you think about what taxes are, if you think about, let's say, I don't know what the case is in Australia, but in the UK, we have a very high level of tax on cigarettes. We have a very high level of tax on alcohol. We have a tax on sugar. We have a tax on burning fossil fuels, etc. What are those taxes all designed to do? Well, partly it's about raising revenue, but the other thing it's about inhibiting that activity. You're raising the tax on sugar to stop people consuming sugary products. You're raising the tax on cigarettes, in theoretically, to stop them smoking. Now, what happens when you tax business, jobs, and employment? You are inhibiting business, jobs, and employment. And of course, we live in a world in which the people who are at the top of society economically are the most mobile they've ever been. And so what you're simultaneously doing is not only inhibiting those activities, but you're pushing them out to other jurisdictions. And if you're somebody who, you know, living in Dubai is a kind of, you know, it's not for everybody, but there are lots of people who will happily live in Dubai and pay zero tax and live in a place where you can leave your gold-plated mobile phone on top of your Lamborghini outside and nothing will happen to it. You know, there will be people for whom that is a much better option. And many of those people don't have to go to Dubai. They can also go to... they go to the US, they go to lots of other places. I know lots of people, British people, who are moving to Australia. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying all of these things are that much better in Australia, but even if everything was the same in Australia, you've got a better climate.
There is a noticeable difference in infrastructure, I got to say. I mean, when you go to the UK, and it is noticeable that things are falling apart in a way that they're not
right
in Australia.
Right.
Yeah.
But and safety-wise as well. I mean, Sydney and Melbourne, you know, outside of some horrific recent incidents, on a day-to-day basis, walking around Sydney and Melbourne, I didn't feel the way I feel. I feel more safe walking around New York at this point.
Yeah. I mean, the problem about taxes is that argument is often abused by people on the right to justify endlessly reducing taxes as well. So, I mean, if you think of Republican administrations in the United States, they basically have swallowed a fantasy that there is no amount of tax cuts that won't pay for themselves by increasing productivity such that the, you know, the revenue will increase nonetheless. And they do it over and over and over again, and it never actually turns out that way. I mean, the deficits do keep getting bigger every time they cut taxes. So how do you know where you are on the Laffer curve? How can you be sure that increasing or introducing a wealth tax in order to fund more police would tank the economy?
Well, because the taxes they've introduced are already tanking the economy, and the taxes are not being spent. See, the rationale for the left-wing economic theory, which I think is often a valid approach to economics in certain economic situations, is that you borrow money in order to invest the money into things, and those things then generate returns, and as a result of that, you get returns on your investments, which allows you to effectively pay off your investments later down the line. But that is not what we're doing. 60% of our current borrowing goes to pay off previous borrowing. We are borrowing money to repay our previous debt, and we're borrowing money to fund a huge welfare bill that we have in this country, whereby basically more than 50% of the country receives more in benefits than it pays in tax. And that portion of the population is obviously incentivized to keep electing people who promise to spend more tax money on more things, on more benefits, on more support for this, more help for that. But in terms of where we are on the Laffer curve, we have the highest tax burden in the history of this country in peacetime. So that sort of tells you that we are towards the other side of it. Now, I take your point. You know, I'm not someone who believes taxation is theft. I believe in redistribution. I believe in some sort of welfare state. But what we have now is a welfare state that traps people in welfare instead of helping them get off it. So if you are somebody who's, you know, had a bad year and you lose your job and you're a bit depressed, we don't help you get back into the jobs market. We give you money so that you can live without ever getting a job ever again, because you're a bit depressed because you lost your job. So the welfare bill is astronomical. We had a great episode with Fraser Nelson talking about this. So that's where we are. And the economy is effectively, it's unproductive. You've got net zero, which is just driven out all industry. On top of that, the tax burden that we have is pushed. Everyone I know who has a business that's portable is trying to leave the country.
Mm. When you say the tax bill is larger than it's ever been, do you mean as a proportion of GDP or in like pound terms?
As a proportion of GDP, it's 38%.
That's amazing. Where's it all going?
Right. I told you, on welfare. But our interest repayment budget, I believe our spending on interest repayment on paying off previous debt is double our defense budget.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, that the austerity that, like the cuts that had to happen during the Great Recession and the spending that had to happen during COVID, that there was no strategic plan about how to grow ourselves out of those, those deficits. What do you see?
But that's for the reasons that I gave you. The incentive structure is for people to vote for people who promise to give them more money at every opportunity. And that money has to come from somewhere. And what Britain has done over the last several decades is sell off all the infrastructure that it could. So the water company that messed up my water for 2 weeks, they're owned partly by Australians and partly by somebody else and partly by someone else.
Sorry about that.
It is all your fault. Our nuclear power stations, some of them are owned by foreign countries to that level. Some of them are strategic adversaries, you might say. We've got like Chinese investments in our nuclear energy, et cetera. I think I'm right about that. So we sold off everything we could, and then we borrowed everything we could, which is why we come back right to the beginning of our conversation. This situation is fiscally unsustainable. Everyone who is a sensible economic commentator that I know believes there is a fiscal crisis coming. That is where the people who lend you the money say, we actually can't lend you any more money because we're not sure you're going to pay it back. At which point you have drastic actual austerity. Mm. Actual austerity. Not we're going to cut things by 2%. No, you actually cut things by 20, 30, 40%, and you begin to live within our means. We begin to live within our means. That's going to be terrible. It's going to be horrific for lots and lots of people. It's going to kill lots of people. It's going to be terrible for their quality of life, life expectancy. All these things are going to suffer, but that is what's coming.
And so when you say that people keep voting for politicians who will promise to give them more money, what's happening to the right in the UK? Because I would never have guessed that we would have the realignment that we seem to be seeing, where the most popular candidate for the prime ministership is Nigel Farage, and essentially the, you know, the other major party instead of the Tories now seems to be the Farage's party. What is that about? Is that what's fueling that?
Well, what's fueling that is that we interviewed Kemi Badenoch, who is the current leader of the Conservative Party, who took over after the terrible performance of the last election. And I think one of the first things she said to us is, we talked right but governed left. The Conservative Party behaved effectively like the Labour Party when they were in charge for a very long time. They will argue that, you know, they had a coalition government with the Lib Dems. Then they had the whole Brexit thing that took up 4 years. The moment they were done with Brexit, COVID came along. The moment they were done with COVID, Ukraine came along. And so, you know, they were the victims of circumstance. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I also think it's a convenient excuse for the fact that they lacked the balls to do the things that they needed to do. And also partly, you know, the Conservative Party is a coalition, part of which isn't really switched on to these issues, and wasn't really prepared to talk about the things that you and I are talking about in an open way. And so effectively what the Conservatives have done is they've completely decimated their own brand to the point where, to the person who would vote for Nigel Farage, which is an increasingly large swathe of the country, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party don't look that dissimilar to each other, in that they both did the same thing. They're both massively discredited. They are both not going to do the things that they need to do to effectively rescue the country from the malaise that it's in. And so Nigel Farage, his popularity is explained by that, but also Zach Polanski, the leader of the Green Party, has become very popular because the left-wing answer to these very same problems looks like a left-wing populist who talks about, you know, a wealth tax and the rich aren't paying their fair share, which is whatever you may think about the rich. And, you know, I don't know whether this is the case in Australia. In Britain, we are trained from a very young age to hate the rich because they're evil and blah, blah, blah. Well, unfortunately for us, the top 1%, these evil people, they pay 33 to 34% of all income and capital gains tax in the country. So when you demonize them and chase them out of the country, you know, however morally righteous you may feel doing it, you're chasing away one out of 100 people who pay 33 out of every 100 pounds we earn. So it's not a particularly viable strategy. But my point is, left-wing populism is also on the rise for the reasons that we've spent the last 20-odd minutes discussing.
One of the solutions that the left would probably propose is then all Western countries should probably band together and implement some kind of universal tax at the same time. You sometimes hear this about corporate taxes, right? So that corporations can't offshore themselves to Ireland or to some low tax environment. So everyone agrees on a baseline bottom for their wealth taxes and their corporate taxes. Uh-huh. Is that a good idea?
No, it's a terrible idea, because what you are doing is you're making yourself uncompetitive, and the people we've been discussing will simply do what they're already doing, which is go to the Middle East and go to America, which is never going to sign up to this in a million years. You're not going to get around the reality that taxing people who are business owners too high is going to push them to places that tax them less.
I think in the thought experiment, America is ruled by Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren and is on board. So the people would have to go to Dubai, because presumably they're not going to be on board. But there are all kinds of reasons why people don't want to set up large industries that service the West outside of the West.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, that thought experiment is a thought experiment. It would never happen in reality, because America is not a country that is going to sign up to that in a million years.
How do you work, Constantine? I'm interested in just pivoting to the success of the podcast, your career. How much preparation do you do? What does a day look like? Because a lot of people who are starting out are like, what do I do when I'm trying to create an independent creative space for myself in this world?
Well, again, very different questions, because today we're at a point where we've got 10, no, 12. Yeah, if you include me and Francis, there are 12 people working at Trigonometry now. So our day looks very different to somebody starting out and to us when we were starting out. And also, you know, preparation-wise, it really depends. We have some guests who are like comedians, and we might just, you know, joke around with them, and we don't prepare a huge amount. If we're interviewing Benjamin Netanyahu, we're gonna brush up on our Middle Eastern history and politics a little bit. So it really fundamentally depends on what the interview is and what the nature of it is. Sometimes, you know, we interviewed Dave Smith, or we had a discussion with Dave Smith, which was obviously going to be a discussion in which there was going to be lots of disagreement. So you prepare for that in a very different way to a conversation where you're interviewing someone and you're just letting them rip. So it really depends. A lot of my time is spent doing more kind of, in addition to the interviews, more strategic stuff, or where we're going, who we want to interview, how many of this type of interview we want to do this year, you know, what innovation do we want to add, what extra content do we want to put out. So more kind of CEO type stuff as well.
Is there a craft to interviewing?
I think so, yeah, for sure. I guess if people ask me, you know, what Not that they necessarily should take me as someone who's particularly good at it, but if people were interested in my approach, our approach is, number one, there has to be a base level of rapport, at least at the beginning, and respect that the guest feels, no matter how much you might disagree with them. So even when we had a woman called Deborah Frances White on of the Guilty Feminist podcast, which is one of our most viral episodes because she acted in a very unreasonable way. Even with her, she had a good 30-40 minutes to set out her case, where we didn't interject, we didn't argue, because, you know, so establishing that basic level of mutual respect and the feeling that the person is going to get to say what they want to say is really important. And that's important even with people with whom you profoundly disagree. But it's even more important with people where, you know, they might be a very controversial figure who is also saying some really important things. And you have to find a way to do both. When we interviewed Tommy Robinson, which was, you know, a big call on our part at the time, and a lot of people, you know, to this day, people think, you know, that was really cool. There's a profile of me in Telegraph out today. This is like the headline, and they talk about it all the time. But for us, it was important that we let him express himself fully and get his message across, while also challenging him on the things that we genuinely thought he's worth challenging on. And that's kind of just the basic approach we have. Is, I think a lot of journalism got itself into trouble because the journalists began to ask themselves the question, what questions do other people think I should ask of this person? We don't ever do that. We go, what question do we want to ask this person? What question do we think is right to ask this person? What is it about this person that we feel has to be brought to the surface, good and bad? What are the areas of disagreement that we have to address because they are critical to this person's worldview? That's kind of how we go about it.
Doesn't that mean that you're likely to be more sympathetic or go easier on people who you agree with than people you don't? And is that okay?
Yeah, we are easier on people that we agree with. And that is okay, because we do not pretend to be unbiased. We pretend to be objective to the best of our ability, but we have opinions which we are upfront about. So if I'm talking to somebody who thinks a wealth tax is a good idea, I don't think a wealth tax is a good idea. And we're not going to have that conversation from the perspective of the wealth tax is a great idea. If I'm talking about wealth tax with someone who thinks it's a bad idea, we probably won't spend as long talking about it because we both agree. And we'll talk about
the tradition of old school journalism, though, would not be that you should agree with people's ideas. It would be that whatever the idea is, you probe it fearlessly, taking a sort of devil's advocate position.
Sure. I I do play devil's advocate occasionally, but there are issues on which I don't play devil's advocate because I'm not that interested in exploring the alternative position on whether gravity is real. It doesn't appeal to me. And it's the same case for, you know, does a three-year-old have the intellectual capacity to decide their sex and other things of that nature, where I know what I think, I'm pretty comfortable with what I think, and I'm not going to explore the devil's advocate position. If you disagree with that position, I will argue with you in order to establish where we both sit on that issue and how strong and robust your argument is. And if your argument is stronger than mine, I'll then adopt your argument. But yeah, there are things on which I play devil's advocate, but on a lot of issues, I don't feel the need to.
Yeah. I mean, isn't then there a risk that there are interesting ways in which your own ideas could be challenged when they come out of the mouths of a guest that you're missing because you don't go after it?
No, because in order to be challenged, we bring on a guest who disagrees with us about that issue, and then we have a robust discussion about that.
Those are the best episodes. I mean, that one that you just mentioned, Deborah, what was her name?
Frances White.
Frances White was one of the ones that I listened to when I knew that we were going to be speaking, because I had a lot of time when I was traveling last week. And it is, I think it's one of the best episodes that you've done, really, because it is so contentious. And I think you guys are at your best when you're hackles are up and when the guest is kind of being a bit obstreperous, and you can call them out on it, but in a, like an intellectually stimulating way. It's not nasty. It is just like there's a genuine clash of worldviews. How do you decide how many interviews to do like that versus the ones where you're inviting somebody on whose worldview you basically agree with, where, you know, you can have a friendly...
On that issue, we're not that strategic, Josh, honestly. We're just like, who should we have on in the next few months? Oh, this person's asked to come on, or that person looks interesting, or should we, you know, we probably have a good discussion with that. So, for example, on our last America trip, we even went as far as inviting Nick Fuentes on. This is somebody with whom we profoundly disagree, as you can imagine. He chickened out, Candace Owens likewise. But... you know, we're always trying to get those interviews with people with whom there's profound disagreement because we feel there's a lot of value. It's not about, you know, is this going to be a great episode or whatever. We also feel there's a way of responsibility on us now with the platform that we have to bring on people who are talking shit to large audiences and to show you that they're talking shit.
How important is it that at the end of the interview you feel like you have exposed them as talking shit?
Well, it depends really, right? So for example, when we had Dave Smith on, right? I don't know if you've seen that episode.
Yeah, I did. I listened to it.
I wouldn't necessarily, look, I profoundly disagree with Dave. And I do think that a lot of people would have walked away from that with the view that his arguments are incorrect. There'll be some people who walk away from that thinking my arguments or Francis' arguments incorrect. But I wouldn't describe Dave as talking shit because he's just got a different opinion about something.
Yeah, no, when you're talking about friendly, actually. I don't think that was, you know, I've heard him on like Coleman Hughes' podcast where Coleman really forensically goes through what Dave believes and, you know, sort of journalistically takes it apart. I didn't find your interview with him to be combative or...
No, it wasn't. He was respectful, but there was profound disagreement. And both his arguments and our arguments got explored thoroughly. So I think you could easily walk away from that, you know, with a perspective on how accurate both sides of the argument were. You learned something about how valid or not, you know, those arguments are, I feel. And we didn't go in to expose Dave, and we didn't go in to show you that he's talking shit. But there are others with whom, yeah, of course, you're bringing them on in order to expose the inaccuracy and falsehood of their ideas. Although even with Deborah, one of the reasons that, you know, I eventually ended up kind of going at her pretty hard is I actually didn't go in to that conversation with an intent to show you that she's an idiot or she's wrong about stuff. We actually went into it with the intent of having a genuine conversation. She asked to come on the show. I think that's a pretty courageous thing to do. I respect that, to come on a show where you know that people are not going to agree with you and to ask to come on. Now, obviously, she had a book to plug, but nonetheless. And so that's why we gave her a lot of time to set her argument out. But the reason I went at her is that the first time I challenged her, she became very nasty and manipulative, and she tried to put words in my mouth and act like I'd said something horrific and all of this other stuff. And if you want to play that game, well, I don't necessarily particularly enjoy playing that game, but I am pretty good at it. And so if you want to come at me in that way, then you're going to find out that that game can be played in both directions.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, do you think that you treat that like the amount of conviviality versus pushback is the same in the Dave Smith conversation as it would be in someone you disagree with more on the other side of politics, a Bassem Youssef or a lefty?
But Bassem Youssef is exactly the same. Before the interview, we were super friendly with him. Because I used to do comedy and Francis still does, there's a kind of stand-up brotherhood thing going on there where it's like, you know, we've all done this kind of thing. So again, the Bassem Youssef interview is another one where we opened it being like incredibly friendly and reasonable. And he acted the way that he acted, at which point I then had to go, oh, wait, this interview is going in a totally different direction. I'm going to have to ask this guy the same question 20 times because he won't answer it. My degree of conviviality is primarily based on the other person's behavior. If you come into the Trigonometry studio and you have zero ideas I agree with, but you're pleasant about it, we're going to have a pleasant conversation.
Yeah. What does conventional journalism get wrong then on that? Because the decline of the legacy media, I mean, I have my own ideas having been in there, is much talked about. The freedom of the independent media is much talked about, but also the concerns about the fact that we don't have any editorial oversight. So we can just go out there and we can all talk to Daryl Cooper about how Hitler was the good guy in World War II as much as we want to. Right. What do you make of your own conception of guardrails, if there are any?
Again, several questions there. So in terms of what the mainstream media gets wrong, I think it sort of peaked with the Kathy Newman, Jordan Peterson interview, which was a very good example to me of what the media had become. It had become a place where an actual conversation was unlikely, if not impossible. It was a fake conversation. It was fake people having a fake conversation in a fake place.
And just to remind people of that conversation, it was a British journalist, and she sat down with Jordan, and she came in with obviously a preconception about what she thought Jordan was, and every time he tried to articulate himself, she would just sort of say, "So what you're really saying is," and she'd say something completely different, which just strawmanned him as if he was a misogynistic, yeah, sexist dinosaur.
Yeah. And on top of that, you say that she came in with a preconception. That is true, but I don't think that's the only thing that happened there. I think it was that plus she came in with an agenda to prove that her preconception was correct. When we have a guest on Trigonometry, we will, of course, we're human beings. So if we've invited a person on, we have some idea of who they are or who we think they are. But if they prove themselves to be a different way, we will run with that conception that is different to the one we had. And Dave Smith is a very good example of that. I grew to respect and like Dave without growing to respect his arguments even remotely more than I did before we had the conversation because of the way he conducted himself. He was respectful. He was friendly. He played the ball, not the man. And I go, okay, well, my preconceptions about this guy have shifted. I actually think his only crime, you know, we got a lot of shit from our side, so to speak, the people who agree with us, for having him on and for the way that we had the conversation. But his only crime is that he has a different opinion. There are a lot of people where my preconception of them was they're probably going to be a decent person. And actually, we learned in the course of the interview that they weren't. So my point is that the problem with the Kathy Newman interview is what it exposed is that when a journalist brings someone on like her to have a conversation, they already know the conversation they want to have. And therefore, it's no longer a conversation. That's not how a conversation is. Mm. If you go to meet a friend to have the conversation you've decided you want to have, well, think about the experience on the other end of that. Your friend is not going to enjoy that. It's very unlikely to enjoy that, especially if what you've come in with is an agenda that is you're determined to prove that they're evil, basically, right? And so I just think I respect a combative and a probing interview. I think that's really important. I enjoy being interviewed in that way. if I know that that's kind of the tenor of the discussion, I enjoy participating in that. But it's got to be done in a constructive way. And I just felt that the media had moved far, far away from that. Now, partly it's a technological thing. They ended up going for a shorter and shorter soundbite. And new media opened up the length of that soundbite all the way up to 3 or 4 hours sometimes. Unfortunately, that is now being reduced back. So I see clips of trigonometry all the time where someone's been clipped out of context and misrepresented. But I guess at least the reassuring thing to me is we are not doing that, right? The media would do that. They would get somebody on. They wouldn't show you the full thing. They'd show you 2 minutes in which they'd often be very badly misrepresented. So that I think is the biggest thing. And then, of course, the other thing is, again, I don't believe in this some kind of evil cabal where people sit down and decide what the news agenda is. But there was a sense in which I think journalists became very monocultural in terms of it's interesting. At the very same time that the idea of diversity, equity and inclusion got pushed very hard, you got lots of diversity of faces and genitals and sexual orientations and all these other things. While all of these people basically came from the same background, they were pretty well off. They went to university. They all had the same opinions about most things. And anyone who didn't was kind of seen as the pariah on that. And that created a monoculture on lots of things. So there was a kind of cozy consensus about immigration. There was a cozy consensus about economics. There was a cozy consensus about the climate crisis, so to speak, and lots of other things.
Yeah, I mean, it was even having worked on the coalface in public broadcasting, I can say that there was another element to it apart from the monoculturalism of the cohort, which was that the diversity logic was that it would be offensive to a minority community to report on the concerns of that community by anyone other than a member of that community. So it became inconceivable over the past 10 years that you would write about LGBTQIA plus issues and did not assign that story to queer people working in the queer vertical of the organization. Similarly, you wouldn't write about racism unless it was a person of color. And what that did was that it just dramatically reduced the diversity of points of view because you're supposed to be writing for the entire community and producing for the entire community, not just your sub-community. So if you're, you know, if you're covering the controversy over pediatric transgender care and the only people who are writing about it are people who are ideologically essentially activists for one side of the position, it's, you know, it's almost like every story about mining has to be written by someone in the mining industry. I mean, you would immediately see that there's a conflict there and that that is, you know, you need a broader diversity of voices. But the narrowness of the definition of what constituted diversity led directly to a lack of diversity in the things that, you know, the kinds of points of view that were being considered within each topic.
Course, just on that, Josh, very often people from within a community who had an opinion that did not align with the opinion that was common in the journalistic institution were never at the table to speak for that part of their community. So if you were, for example, a Black person who did not agree with the BLM narrative and thought that actually the problems of the Black community are elsewhere, you were never going to get a chance to write that story and to make that case, because partly you were never going to be in the room in the first place. Yeah. Because diversity didn't mean Black people, it meant Black people with an opinion that matched the opinion of the people who hired them.
Certainly. And yes, I mean, even if it only meant Black people, there are only so many people you can hire. And if the majority of Black people think a certain way, then they're also likely to be the most enthusiastic about prosecuting that particular case. And so they're probably going to put their hands up to be covering Black issues more. Whereas, I mean, it's a self-reinforcing loop. And as you know, I mean, I was an out gay broadcaster in Australia who wanted to write about my conflictedness about pride, and that was not considered kosher But at the same time, the broadcaster was the official sponsor of Pride. And so the argument that the reason why they objected to my talking out about it was because, you know, I'm not allowed to express a biased political opinion was ludicrous, because every other show on the network was constantly a cavalcade of drag queens and, you know, and Pride advocates. But the one gay person on the network wasn't allowed to pipe up. So, yes, but I do think that moment is ending. And I do think that there is a hazard for us in the alternative media, in the sense that if the definition of who is a good person to have on the show is, are they convivial and easy to get along with and not a sort of obstreperous and obstinate during the interview, then the whole landscape can be gamed if charming right-wing idiots just learn that being really chatty and convivial is the best way to broadcast bad ideas. Because, you know, Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes and, you know, I don't want to offend people by lumping them into that bucket, so I won't go down the sliding scale, but there's a spectrum of people who are much more actually charming and really nice. Like, I mean, I've had Candace on this show, fabulous to chat to, completely toxic to the culture, I think, and totally delusional about a large number of issues. But if my yardstick is, well, I'll have convivial conversations with people who are good at having convivial conversations, and I'll have argumentative ones with people who are argumentative, don't we get sucked into the risk of, I suppose, slanting the scale in favor of whoever learns that conviviality is the trick?
I actually think the incentive structure in new media is even worse than what you've described.
G'day, humans. Well, if you've listened to this much of the episode, then you must enjoy it, presumably, unless you're just listening for masochistic reasons. So you should listen to the rest of it. And the way you do that is by subscribing to the premium feed, where you not only get to hear the rest of this delightful conversation, and trust me, oh, it gets better than what you just heard, but you also get to hear no ads, zero ads. And previously, up until now, you had to go to the old Substack to do that, and follow me on Substack and add one more platform to your life if you're not already on Substack. But here's the thing. We are now on Apple Premium Podcast as well. So with one click, Apple will just subscribe you up to the premium feed. You'll be able to listen to the rest of this conversation right now. So open up your Apple Podcasts, click the old Pay Old Zepsy button. That's probably what it's called, Pay Old Zepsy. And you click the button, and then you no longer have to be a free rider. You can feel like you're contributing to the mission of this show, which is really what we're all here for: better conversations, a freer, more freewheeling attitude towards the things that we can talk about, a way to steelman our opponents and to take the most gracious approach towards disagreement. That is what you're voting for when you vote for Uncomfortable Conversations by going into your Apple Podcasts and clicking subscribe. I love you. If you don't do that, that's fine. I'll see you the next free episode, I guess. Take care.